It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. My next guest is Nadia Hashimi, who a couple of years ago had a best-selling book called The Pearl That Broke Its Shell. And now she's back with a new novel called When the Moon is Low. It's about a family in Afghanistan that has to get out of there because of the Taliban. Now, right there is a word you haven't heard much about in the last few years. Of course, we heard a lot about ISIS. We've heard a lot about Al-Qaeda. But we haven't heard much about the Taliban. But they are the reason that we went in there in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks, because, of course, the Taliban was allowing Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda to have a presence there and have their terrorist camps, etc. And they were doing horrible things to the people of their country, particularly the women. And so, Nadia, let's start right there by talking about the Taliban. Are they as bad now as they were then?
The Taliban never fully went away in Afghanistan. They sort of died down because they weren't in control any longer. The negotiations now between the existing government and Afghanistan, there are talks about opening the discussion channels in order to have some of the people who were part of the Taliban during that time period be part of the face of Afghanistan in the new in the coming years, and incorporating them into rebuilding the government. So that's what's making a lot of women's organizations very nervous.
What does that make you think as an Afghan-American woman, the Taliban being part of the government there?
I can understand the existing, the Afghan government's motivations for wanting to incorporate them, because you'd rather have them be part of the conversation, be part of the team as you're rebuilding the country, rather than to be an opposition force that could destabilize the nation. But at the same time, as a woman looking at the situation, you want to make sure that they're going to be sitting at the table along with women. And that's where really the problems have been, is that they're not really willing to negotiate with the women's organizations and to make sure that women's voices are also part of the conversation and very much part of Afghanistan's future.
I didn't know much about the Taliban until Jay Leno's wife, Mavis Leno, and her group, The Feminist Majority, in the late 90s, were alerting the world to how women were being mistreated by the Taliban and really oppressed by the Taliban. You must have known people, women who were going through that at the time. What did they tell you life was like under Taliban rule?
You know, from what we gathered, it was oppressive, as people said. There were also people remarking that Afghanistan had already been in a couple of decades of war. And so the people who had living through that 20 years of war, so were very tired, were very just fatigued and devastated by it. And when the Taliban entered certain areas, there was almost this acquiescence of, you know what, fine, if you guys will at least bring us peace, we could live by your rules. So there was sort of a mixed bag of reactions to the Taliban, but overall, just a very difficult situation for people who were really pro-education for girls and pro a bit of gender equality.
Yeah, I want to talk about the education part of this, because in addition to women not being allowed to go out without an escort from a man that they were related to, couldn't even go to a doctor, there couldn't be a female doctor that they could go to see. If they went to a male doctor, they couldn't talk to them. They had to have a male member of their family kind of be their interpreter. But also, we know that the Taliban was destroying schools and not letting girls get an education. And I wonder what that means for generational impact now, 15, 20 years later.
So there was definitely a portion of Afghanistan's history where girls were not able to go to school. What happened when the schools reopened was that there was a rush back to the schools. You had a lot of girls of various ages kind of entering and restarting. So sometimes girls that were older coming back into the younger grades, but people just wanting to have an education and didn't really care that they weren't going to be able to enter at an appropriate age level. You have at this point now the students in Afghanistan, 36% of them are girls. So there's definitely been a resurgence in the female population attending schools and obtaining an education. You have girls who are going for higher level degrees as well and establishing themselves in those careers that they've been missing.
Now, all of this is woven into the plot of your novel, When the Moon is Low. Tell my audience about that.
When the Moon is Low is the story of an Afghan family. They're living in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, and they have a very middle-class and normal existence prior to that. under the Taliban, their lives are turned upside down, and when they lose the father of the family, the mother is forced to make some really tough decisions for her, for herself and for her three children, and they set their sights on Europe to build their lives and restart over there, and along the way, they are separated and have to reunite.
They have to reunite somehow. They have to get the family back together. But that's a problem that a lot of refugee families are finding themselves going through, right?
Absolutely. You know, the journeys from point A to point B are very harrowing when we look at around the world. This is not just an Afghan story anymore. When we're looking at refugees, we're looking at people all over the globe who have their sights not only on Europe but on other countries as well. And the journeys are perilous. We have, you know, the stretch of land that they're trying to cross may take their lives. We have stretches of water that have been very deadly, or boats that are capsizing or being struck down. So the journeys that people are making are pretty harrowing, and some of those, I think it's definitely worth talking about. It's worth understanding what kind of risks people are taking and why. What are the motivations for that?
Last week was World Refugee Day, and I was reading some numbers about that, and I saw under the category of Syria, something like 1 million refugees, and something like maybe 150,000 or 200,000 of those are women who are running their families while they're running for their lives because there's no man around anymore.
Exactly. And, you know, there are some really staggering figures that are being thrown about. For example, there are about 60 million displaced persons around the world right now. That's a huge bump, and a lot of that is because of the Syrian refugee crisis. And specifically, as you've mentioned, the women refugees, those are the people who are now all of a sudden heads of household, if you want to think of it that way. And these are people who are trying to bring their children to a new life without really the resources to do it. And these are people who really want to start anew, and without giving them an opportunity, we're looking at a very large population that's going to be disenfranchised.
Did these women become head of household because their husband died or because their husband said, you take the kids and get out of Syria, I have to stay here and fight Assad?
I'm sure there's lots of different kinds of stories. A lot of women were forced to flee for the reasons that you mentioned. So, you know, what the breakdown of those reasons are is, I'm not sure how it really breaks down, but I think that's really what's worth knowing, is those human stories and those motivations of how these families are struggling to either reunite or to recover from devastation.
Where are a lot of these refugees, whether from Syria or Afghanistan or elsewhere, among that 60 million that you mentioned, where are they going?
Well, 38 million of the displaced are actually displaced within their own country. The remainder are spread out throughout the world. And so clearly people are going to go to either bordering countries. For example, when refugees have fled Afghanistan, Afghanistan's been the world's largest producer of refugees for the past three decades, and now Syria is a big producer. But when refugees fled Afghanistan, they fled, you know, 95% of the people went to either Pakistan or Iran, because those are the neighboring countries. And so it's probably the same situation when you look at where people are going from today's group of people that are making that kind of an exodus. Bordering countries, so you have Turkey getting a huge influx. But then people also have their sights on nations that may have better opportunities for them. And so countries like Greece, where they're that point of entry into Europe, although they may not be destined for Greece, they may have their eyes on countries like Germany or England that have the better resources and a reputation for helping refugees. But their landing point is really going to be Greece, and we do see Greece being flooded with refugees.
Yeah, I feel sorry for them. They get to Greece and they go, oh, finally a place with a good economy. Whoops!
Right, right, right. And I think that's a lot of the problem, is that many nations are poorly equipped to handle this influx of people. Like Greece, for example. I mean, Greece is talking about bankruptcy and austerity and withdrawal from the European Union.
Yep.
They're not the people to turn to when we're looking to support a mass of people looking for a new life.
In your book, your characters travel to Greece and to Italy and to France and to England, and they have troubles along the way, which we won't reveal. We want people to read the book When the Moon is Low to find out about that and follow their stories. But in the real world, how are those refugees doing? Are they finding a good new life where they land in Europe?
Refugees are received very differently in different places, and it takes a long time for them to get back on their feet, but they're able to do it, and I think that's part of the story that's important to keep in mind. You know, in some countries, refugees are accepted, and if they're granted political asylum, they may have some assistance in resettling and just getting back on their feet. In some countries, they may not be allowed to go to enter schools or, you know, work in certain places. But overall, people who have been able to resettle are successful. And I myself know people in the United States who have come here as refugees who are now working as linguists or bank tellers, interpreters for different organizations, or taxi drivers, or small business owners who are now employing other people, or physicians who are treating people of the community.
Well, you know, we, speaking of the United States, we hear a lot of loudmouths in the media talking about, oh, immigrants in our country, immigrants in our country. But we do have quite a few refugee groups that have come here, here in the St. Louis area. This metropolitan area has welcomed a lot of Bosnian refugees here over the last two decades. Is America a good place for these refugees from Afghanistan, Syria, et cetera, in the Middle East to come to?
Well, if you can ask the refugees that, but I would tell you that for the refugees that I've spoken with, this is the dreamland, and that's because the American dream does really exist. So, yes, there may be some resentment or some backlash from some voices in the country, but overall, this is a place where people can start anew, and they have the opportunities to, if they put their mind to it, to really succeed, and I've seen it happen so many times within my own family. The American dream is very much alive, and I think that kind of hope is really what fuels the refugees to understand that they don't have to be refugees forever. That's not a label that's going to stick with them. They can rebuild.
I've only got one more minute here. Tell me about the only time in your life you've gone back to Afghanistan.
That was in 2002, and I made a fantastic trip there with a very mixed bag of emotions. So, you know, seeing the destruction of the many years of war and the effects that had on the childhood homes of my parents and on the family that lived there, and at the same time watching brand new buildings come up and hospitals go up and lines of school children looking to get back into an education. So it was a great time to see the shift in Afghanistan.
Her first book was called The Pearl That Broke Its Shell. It was a big bestseller. The new one is called When the Moon is Low. Nadia Hashimi, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.